episode 58, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Michael Biersick, CEO and founder of QControl. The team discuss quantum education, infrastructure software, error correction, and the quantum computing stack. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey Cyprian, how you doing?
Hi Patrick, I'm doing well and looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
Oh, we're all going to be very excited about this one. Michael, yeah, thanks for joining us, and could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, thank you very much for having me. My name is Mike Biersick. I'm the CEO and founder of a company called QControl.
I'm very excited to talk to you because when QControl first came out with your Black Opal online training, for lack of a better way to characterize it, I was one of the first members to jump in, I think. I probably wasn't first, but as soon as I heard about it, I jumped on. I love the way you guys presented the concepts, the picket fence analogies for how waveforms are blocked in polarization. There's lots of good innovation there. And you're doing the good work of spreading the quantum, but you do quite a lot more as well at the company QControl. Can you tell us about what you guys are up to?
Absolutely. First of all, we're really grateful for your partnership and support. We're very excited to roll out Black Opal last year, so anybody can learn quantum computing. But learning quantum computing is really something that we are supporting in order to help grow the ecosystem of users of our more technical solutions. QControl is a company that focuses on something called infrastructure software. We make software that makes quantum hardware perform better. And that means quantum hardware for computing and quantum hardware for sensing and other applications, because in all cases, the hardware is actually quite unstable. It suffers from degradation due to the environment, due to what's called noise. This is really the Achilles heel of the entire sector. So all the tremendous promise that we all hear about how quantum computers are going to solve this problem or that problem, the one thing that really stands in the way is this problem of noise and error degrading the performance of the hardware. That's really the problem that we fundamentally fix all through our expertise in this new discipline of quantum infrastructure software.
Oh, that means that you're at the forefront of the two most important things, because getting the word out is the reason that Cyprian and I both are doing this podcast. Neither one of us is primarily in the business of quantum computing. I'm cybersecurity. He's big data and artificial intelligence. But we believe it's critical that more people start to get on board and understand this. And that's why I think Black Opal is a big hit. But then the other thing is the noise. I mean, when you're operating at 20, 30 millikelvin, everything's noise. Heat itself is noise. So I think it's exciting that we're seeing a maturation of the quantum space by companies like yourselves going after specific problems as opposed to trying to be the whole stack and solve everything. And so sometimes we try to characterize this as we're in the middle of the beginning or the beginning of the beginning. I think this is a clue that we might be near the end of the beginning, hopefully. Yeah. Is there anything that you guys are working on, especially that you wanted to talk about today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're working on so many different things right now, but all linked to this this concept of infrastructure software. Maybe just to comment on your last remark there. There is an interesting evolution in our sector that originally, as the sector first became industrialized as opposed to scientific or academic, there was a very simple bifurcation. And that bifurcation was you either do hardware or you do software. And what people meant by software was really applications, things that are going to run on future quantum computers one day. Now, we always thought it was a bit early for that because there were so many challenges being faced at the hardware level. But we also knew from our own research, many members of my team have been academic scientists before driving forward in disciplines like quantum control engineering, we knew that software could actually do a huge amount. And so our primary focus has been on software enablement or software enhancement or software augmentation or ruggedization, whichever phrase you like, using techniques delivered via software to help advance the performance of the underlying hardware. Now, another bit of maturation another bit of maturation, you know, related to what you said before, is that very, very early in the dawn of the industrialization, if you will, of this field, every hardware company used the following words: "We are full stack," which in simple parlance meant we're going to do everything. We're going to do it all. Now, the motivation was not silly, right? The motivation is we know the hardware really well. It's early. There are so many problems, and we need to keep focused on that. That is a totally sensible initial perspective. But the idea of companies remaining full stack has largely fallen away. There are a couple of parts of that. One is you don't see Dell making everything from microprocessors all the way to operating systems. That is not how it works. It's just not the paradigm. There's specialization. The other is that we've just been able to show that our team and our software can do things that the hardware teams cannot do with their own systems. We can make the hardware literally thousands of times better in terms of delivering the right answer from an algorithm. So when we started showing these results, you say, just give us access to your machine and we can do independent tests. You can validate it yourself, run it yourself, run the code and see what you get. When we started being able to do that, enabled by fantastic advances in cloud access to these machines, the whole industry started to go in a different direction.
It's like the hardware is the data and you're the algorithm that finds the needle in the haystack.
Well, you know, that's an analogy that comes up a lot in our field. We are, you know, another one that we like is we're helping see the light in the dark, that there's all this randomness, we can make the right answer stand out like a beacon in the midst of all this darkness.
How very quantum.
So I'm really curious, Michael, can you elaborate a little bit on like what is the part of a quantum system that you interact with? Like where do you plug in if you think about like the, let's say, full stack kind of thing, right? The way I see it is you start with, I don't know, a notepad or whatever where you write some code, right? And on the other hand, there is some dilution refrigerator running a bunch of qubits that get maybe controlled by, I don't know, lasers or microwaves or whatever, right? So for me, this is kind of like the spectrum, right? Mm. So I would like to help us and mostly our listeners kind of zoom in a little bit, like where in this spectrum is that, let's say, slice or that part that you are kind of focusing on and integrating?
It's a great question. So let me spend just a second on the stack to give a little more color to that. At the top of the stack, you have what's sometimes called QCAS, quantum computing as a service. So cloud access to quantum machines provided by companies like AWS via Braket or Microsoft Azure, or IBM Quantum. Then at the bottom, you have the physical devices, the chip that's sitting inside a dilution refrigerator or the trapped ions inside a vacuum chamber or whatever the technology may be. Just below the top, just below the quantum computing as a service, you have applications and algorithms. That's where almost all of the software effort lives. We connect those two extremes. We connect the applications and algorithms to the hardware. So we provide solutions in a couple of different layers in the emerging stack. One is called quantum firmware. This is the lowest level of software abstraction where we redefine the machine language and bring autonomy to the hardware. So this leverages our expertise in a very particular discipline called quantum control engineering. And the idea is to make the individual hardware elements, the qubits, and the so-called logic gates that are used to run algorithms, to make those all more resilient to error. So we specialize in this. But then we go just a couple of steps higher. One step up is something you could call hardware-aware compilation. Whenever we have an algorithm, we have to compile it down to a native instruction set. We typically write the algorithm in abstractions that don't necessarily match physically what you do in the hardware. So as an example, many of your listeners will have heard of something called a CNOT, but there is more or less no native CNOT on hardware. You have to turn that into, via the compilation process, what you can actually implement. In addition, sometimes you write, well, I have 5 qubits and qubit 1 interacts with qubit 5 and qubit 2 interacts with qubit 4. But in general, the connectivity of the hardware is not all to all. That means you have to move information around. All these things need to be accounted for in the compilation stage. Now, there have been great compilers on the market for a while, but we saw that the compilers were still too abstract. And so our focus was on trying to incorporate more hardware realism into those compilers by, in particular, worrying about how do you route the data around on the chip. So this is something called layout selection. And we have our own machine learning tools that do this. Or how do you cancel errors that only occur in the circuit, that only occur when you execute the algorithm? We've, as a field, we've primarily focused on the building blocks. So imagine you're making a cinder block wall, right? Everybody's been trying to make really good cinder blocks, but there hasn't been a lot of thought about the mortar that holds the cinder blocks together. So we've been focusing on both elements. That's in the compilation layer. And then one layer up, there is something more called quantum error correction. And I'm sure you've encountered this before. It is very popular in the field because it's so foundational to the idea of building long-term, large-scale quantum computers. Again, we have the particular view that the efforts in quantum error correction have been a bit too theoretical, too abstract. Now, I don't want to undermine the importance of the scientific exploration, but we've just taken a different approach. And the different approach is to say, what does it take to make this practically relevant? And in our view, it's really an engineering or a control engineering challenge. And so we bring these multiple layers together, all in the middle of the stack, to connect. How do you write an algorithm at the top and ensure when you execute it on hardware, you actually get the right answer? That is, you know, that middle of the stack is what we address.
I hope you don't mind this analogy. You sound like the operating system. You know, so, everything from firmware all the way up to giving the apps something to tie into that abstracts the... If I were a cloud provider, this is what I would be looking for so that I could use different modalities of quantum and abstract that away from my client on the app side.
So it's an interesting analogy. I'll give you another one that we tend to use more a little bit more based on some of the peculiarities of the way the quantum stack exists. That's VMware. We're a lot like VMware. We take bare metal hardware and we turn it into useful and high performance computational tools. And we do that by virtualizing the hardware. We break the link between the algorithmic abstraction and the underlying hardware. So you're not any longer writing your algorithm in like assembly language in order to map it to exactly what has to be executed on a particular hardware platform. We take care of that part. So users have the ability to gain portability. They have obviously lower errors, so they have better outcomes. And they ultimately gain higher utility from this approach. But it comes from making that virtualization layer between the hardware and the algorithms.
Interesting. That does.
I very much like that that approach. So you would essentially be the ESXi of the of the quantum industry, to put it that way. So I'm wondering, like, this model that you have, this involves working very closely, I presume, with the chip manufacturers, right? And I also presume that your quantum control layer needs to integrate with the control layers that are built right on top of the physical devices that these manufacturers are providing. Or is that a different approach that you're taking?
It's a very interesting question. And the reality is we get there in two different ways. One way, of course, is we work very closely with the platform vendors, so the companies that build and sell access to quantum computers, to integrate or embed our solutions into the hardware. So I hope your listeners will keep an ear for the news. There will be some announcements later in the year in this direction. But there's another way we can get in, and this leverages the fact that many of the platform vendors, but most prominently IBM, made early investments in the cloud infrastructure so anybody could access their machines. They built really the first quantum cloud service. It has been a tremendous accelerant to progress in the field because instead of trying to do things with pen and paper, we can do them on a machine. what they offered was something called pulse level control. So you can actually change the analog waveforms that are being used to manipulate the hardware. And they have a whole programming interface called Qiskit Pulse that allows you to do that. We simply became the number one power user of this pulse level access. And we built all of our tools and tested them exclusively using that kind of API access. There was no special access behind the scenes, no show up in the lab with a memory stick kind of operation. This was entirely over the public API. And we were still able to show thousands of times enhancement in the performance of the underlying hardware. So we offer a service in another product called FireOpal, where any user can come to us and with a single line of code access and execute their algorithm augmented by our entire error suppression workflow. So they don't have to do anything. They just put in their algorithm like they would have otherwise, do one line of code, and then we handle all of the hardware execution and the error suppression pipeline. So there's
no verticals for you. It's everything in the quantum. If you're going to use a quantum computer, you have the ability to help with that. You're not looking at specific verticals in material science or anything like that.
We are completely agnostic. Now, we have some areas of interest that we've been pushing on in collaboration with partners. That is certainly
makes
true.
Sense.
But everything we do is vertical agnostic. Any algorithm can come through these services. And the other part of it is we help clients get to the right answer through many different channels, either direct integration with hardware or via this independent cloud service, which we announced last year will in the future be on Amazon Braket. So the idea is to be everywhere and to ensure that the kind of technology we have is as widely disseminated as possible.
Oh, that's awesome. That's very, very interesting. I'm very interested in FireOpal. Black Opal was my first introduction to the company, and you guys did a great job on that. Now you have an academic background. Are you based in Sydney?
I have a rather diverse background. I certainly studied in a related field. I have my PhD in quantum physics. I've worked in the U.S. government at an agency called DARPA. I worked at an agency called NIST with the 2012 Nobel laureate, although it was before he won the Nobel Prize, named Dave Wineland, which was a fantastic experience as a research scientist. And then, yes, I established an academic team at the University of Sydney, where I still hold a professorial title, and I founded the company in 2017.
I was going to say I didn't detect an Australian accent there, so I was seeing the thing.
It's my suppressed New York accent.
Okay, all right. So, what do you think is the big challenge ahead for you guys, or for the industry in general? So we had an episode recently where we talked about the hype bubble, and we don't believe it. It's really a thing. There was a very well-known science YouTuber, Sabina Hossenfelder, who talked about the coming winter for quantum, and we kind of refuted that. We don't agree that that's the case. We believe that if just the Shor's algorithm will keep government funding going and the material science potential, that we think that we're just at the beginning of this. Are you seeing indicators either way that there's, you know, too much hype in the system, or that we really haven't even seen it hit its stride yet?
It's a really interesting and important topic of conversation. As you always say, it's useful to understand the messenger. Sabina has more or less said publicly that she finds the most lucrative route for herself is to be the contrarian in this case, right? So it's, I will honestly question whether she even believes what she says. In the concept of the quantum winter, right? This is something that we've been hearing. You know, I went to an event in July 2017 in Munich that was organized by venture capitalists. And that was an event that really spurred me to start the company because I saw how the industry was moving. But even at that event in July 2017, people were talking about hype and the coming quantum winter, right? So now this isn't to say it's impossible, right? But or even that it's unlikely. But I think there has always been this kind of discussion. Now, in a sense, there is a really interesting dynamic playing out. And obviously we have the changes in the economy going on right now. We've seen the overall tech sector get smashed. We've seen any SPAC in any field get smashed in the last year. That clearly flows down to the quantum sector, capital availability and the like. There's no question. And so that will have some negative impact. I think some companies will go down, but I don't think it has anything to do with quantum. It has to do with just like general technology and VC investment.
I agree 100%, but I also think that we have a break on the speed of the hype in this field, and that is something you're trying to address with Black Opal, which is it's a dense area. It's hard for people to jump ship and become experts in this and flood the market with charlatans and things of that nature. So to some extent, I think there's the only area that seems to have a bigger shortage of talent pool than cybersecurity, which is my chosen field, is quantum. And I think that is deferring any potential winter problem because we don't even have enough people who understand it already, let alone too many in the space that have overinflated it. Because it's not really that approachable.
It is not. And you might maybe not be surprised that when Q-Control became more prominent through funding rounds and some of our technical demonstrations, we had a huge number of inbounds to us who said, we really, really are excited about what you're doing. We'd love to use it, but I don't know what a quantum computer is. And so instead of doing consulting, right, which is what many others have done, we decided to build a product. And our approach was to combine the fact that we actually were experts. A number of us in the team were academic faculty teaching quantum physics and even quantum information in different settings. And we now had this new resource, and the resource was incredible engineers and web developers who could help us build tools, visualizations, animations that we never had access to when we were doing chalkboard style lectures or PowerPoint presentation right. style lectures. So we combined that tremendous expertise and real knowledge of everything going on in the field with our product focus. And then we combined them together to actually solve a problem we had, which was we had all these new people joining us in marketing, in general parts of business operations, in software engineering. And these are people who did not understand the context of the field they were working in. So we had to assemble all this material from all sorts of different places and try to share them YouTube videos and whatnot to learn. And so instead we solved the problem with our own software.
I was going to ask that question. I was going to ask it makes perfect sense. We think that we talked recently to a high school teacher who's teaching quantum computing to a high school class, which got us very excited. But we're very much tip of the spear here. We're very much in early days. And I don't know that you can have a hype bubble and a hype winter in an area that hasn't caught on fire the way it really should yet. There's so many areas we haven't plumbed. There's so many ideas and startups that have yet to be broached and created. So, and I think it's interesting to also see where you got your inspiration for starting the company, because right now a lot of what we're seeing is coming out of the academic space, and that makes sense. That's the way it worked with original computing. It came from the military, it came from the governments, and it came from the academic space. And so I think we're on the same page. But what we're looking for later is the abstraction so that the person could use it without understanding it. And I don't, yep. I think you're right. I don't think we're there yet.
I think we're getting close. I think we're getting close, Patrick.
I think so too.
So the way we've been thinking about it is, it was actually really nicely captured by a little report from IDC. They wrote about our tool FireOpal, and they described it as frictionless quantum software, where the idea is remove the friction for the user. And then we went a step further, and we announced a partnership with a company called Classic. It's a company out of Israel. They focus on taking problems and then helping with developer tools to turn those problems into abstracted quantum algorithms. So now nice. Here is our frictionless tool chain. You go from Black Opal, where you go absolutely zero knowledge of quantum computing to understanding how to program in a language called Chasm. It's an intermediate representation we use. Then once you've got the basics, you can just define your problem using classic software, get an algorithm out that connects directly to our software, FireOpal, and go all the way to optimized hardware execution. Now, at that point, there's very limited math that the user has to do aside from the problem definition. There's very limited quantum math. And there's absolutely no effort required whatsoever in making the hardware work right. Right. We've taken care of all of that. So I think we are going in this direction, but it's come from where we started, this maturation in the view of the industry, that there are these additional layers like infrastructure software that are so important to realize the utility of this field for big enterprise clients, as an example.
We're getting very close to the point where Cyprian and I have talked about this before. the programmer won't even know they're leveraging quantum. They'll call on a cloud Lambda function that goes off and runs Grover's or Shor's or some other algorithm, or maybe it runs a Kubo and comes up with an optimization based on the parameterization, and it just goes and does it in the cloud, and you don't even realize it. And so
it's even more than that, Patrick, because it's interesting, right? I believe we're getting to the point where, right now, we focused a lot on the hardware, on the modalities of building, right? Discussing whether trapped ions are better than superconducting and so forth, right? But the real problem that I see is we are having difficulties in framing known problems into a quantum mindset because like one of the things that we're hearing, but in quantum you only have Shor and Grover and a bunch of others, right? The reality is that these building blocks might be sufficient, right? As long as we understand how to frame the problem. So I expect to see a shift from discussing which modalities is better, precisely because of abstracting layers like you folks are building, right? Into the, okay, how do we identify problems and frame them in a way that they can be solved with quantum? And then one of the things that I would like to get your view on, Michael, is how do you see the hybrid approach? Because I, for one, I don't believe we'll ever live in a world where quantum will replace classical. I believe, and we were talking about Shor, right? Shor is the perfect example. You're not solving factorization with quantum. You are solving a specific part, which is the order finding, right? And then I believe we are moving towards a world where the ins and outs, back and forth between classical computing and stacks and quantum computing and stacks are going to be paramount. And I think your approach is perfectly positioned to kind of enable that world. Am I reading this the wrong way?
No, I think you're right on the money. We think that in the medium and then long term, various forms of architecture that hybridize classical and quantum resources will be the way forward. And so one of the things we've been pushing on very hard via our work in quantum infrastructure software is the concept of the software-defined quantum data center. That if you think back to the mainframe days, you would just write code for the hardware that you would be running on, and it would be specific code for a particular processor, and you knew that the code you were writing would actually be executed in that machine. Going back to our earlier discussion, VMware broke that concept with the software-defined data center, giving all this portability. But going into the quantum domain, it requires us not only to have portability between classical and quantum resources, but also between different quantum resources, because they are not natively all the same. One of the things we do with quantum infrastructure software is help to homogenize the performance of these devices such that you have better portability across platforms, across technologies. But overall, a key part of what quantum infrastructure software does is it enables this virtualization to build the software-defined quantum data center. So what will the killer app be? Will it be something using QAOA, one of these quantum optimization algorithms, or variational quantum eigensolver, or will it be something deterministic like Shor? I think this is an area of continued interest, but I think I feel that we have enough confidence in the primitives, that is the underlying building blocks, to say it is a matter of simply trying to demonstrate it. And the proof will be in the pudding. But another angle on this is, I think it's better that we try than only write things with pen and paper and pontificate about what happens if you have an infinitely large machine. And then you can have asymptotic proofs of scaling and whatnot. We just need to do it. And it's really exciting that there are so many academics, companies, big national labs who are taking that similar approach, and we're happy to help many of them.
Oh, go ahead, Cyprian.
Just one quick thing I realized I forgot to ask, because I'm really curious, is like the type of quantum hardware that you interact with, do you have any preference over adiabatic quantum computing versus circuit-based, or you can essentially abstract both of them?
All of the tools that we have released publicly are for gate model quantum computing, but the underlying science we've published on in the past is applicable to adiabatic machines if they have the right kind of control. Unfortunately, the adiabatic machines that are built in the market don't have the kind of control that would make technology relevant.
Sorry, Patrick, for
No, I was going to say that I think the killer app is yet to show itself, and I think it's going to be in the material science. Even though it's more behind the scenes, it's not as flashy. All sci-fi is based on just a future with better material science to store energy, to transfer energy, to endure. Material science is really where I think a lot of the excitement's going to be, in the middle of the quantum story. Maybe we have to wait for the end to get some of our super materials. But I did want to also, since you're in the universal quantum computing, there's other modalities that are just starting to be sussed out. So for example, Microsoft's Mariana particle-based. There's also been talk about a hot quantum computer based on a diamond flaws. I don't know how that would work, but there's lots of new modalities that might still emerge. Is that something you might pursue, or do you wait until it gets to a certain level of maturity before you start really thinking about that kind of stuff?
Well, we always wait for an appropriate level of maturity. And there is a distinction between the two different technologies you mentioned a moment ago. The nitrogen vacancy centers in diamond, or otherwise they're broadly known as color centers in diamond, that technology actually exists. And we actually have customers of some of our software who employ our technology to improve the performance of their nitrogen vacancy-based either computers or sensors. They're very sensitive magnetometers. So the unfortunate thing in that field is that they haven't been building systems, really. They've been building individual devices. So we're not yet at the stage where we're seeing people run big algorithms on those machines. On the other hand, the Majorana devices from Microsoft are at this stage completely speculative. There is some evidence that these particles may exist, but it's led to a major retraction scandal in Science and Nature from some of the academic scientists involved that has led to people questioning whether that data is valid. Irrespective, there are no devices on which anybody can work right now and even run basic qubit-style interactions. We commend Microsoft for taking a big bet on an extremely hard problem, thinking that maybe it would give them some real advantages. And as a scientist, I'm still extremely hopeful that they're successful. But from the business perspective, we have to wait and see if the technology matures further before we began working on it.
I mean, anytime a $1 trillion player decides to go down a road, there's reason to believe they might be able to pull it off. So I don't see anybody else being able to do that in this market, because like you said, it's very early days. But that's why I cite them as an example. So you'd probably wait. You'd wait until they got past the first device stages before you'd worry about them. And I didn't know that about the nitrogen vacancy, that there were actually devices out there that were actually in operation.
There are academic labs. There are a couple of companies that are running these things. They're still very, very small scale, but they are real.
Cool.
The problem that I understand exists with NVCs is it's actually very difficult to create those vacancy centers. Like you could use ones that naturally occur, but artificially creating them is the part that makes this particular modality difficult to scale, if my understanding is correct.
So that is a true statement, broadly. Most of the experimentation that goes on is based on finding these natural color centers. They're just little defects in the crystal lattice of diamond that then, because of the atomic structure, gain quantum properties that can be exploited. So fabricating at scale, repeatedly, placing these nitrogen vacancy centers where people want. It is an ongoing research task. There's great progress in the direction, but it's still a major challenge. The other challenge is connecting them together. These are individual atomic defects that are not easily connected. And so generally this has to be done using light, using photons. And that adds whole new levels of complexity in the way.
Building a CNOT gate with those is not the easiest task possible.
We'd almost have to be able to 3D print a diamond to specification to make that, you know, scale, I would think.
I think you'd be rich in all sorts of other ways if you could do that.
That's true. We're here for the science. That's all. So Michael, we're up 35 minutes. We're past 35 minutes. Time flies. We're having a great conversation, but I do want to make sure anything that we didn't discuss, you get a chance to surface or bring up anything that the company might be doing, some places that you might be appearing. Anything before we unfortunately have to wrap things up that you wanted to add or bring up?
It's been a great conversation. I will add that everything that we talk about in terms of improving performance of hardware with software, we apply to a whole nother vertical, which is called quantum sensing. And here we have some extremely exciting new results where we can ruggedize quantum sensors so that they can operate well on mobile platforms like on boats and aircraft and spacecraft. So we just put out some technical work on this this week, and we'll be making a number of announcements this year. So please stay tuned for major advances in quantum sensing for real applications.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is big news.
I was actually about to ask, like, because you mentioned in the beginning that you're capable of interacting with computing devices, but also with sensors. So you've kind of preempted my question. That is great. And just before we finish, I'm sorry, Patrick.
No problem.
If that will add like a minute or so.
No problem.
In terms of error correction, like, do you feel we've passed that kind of barrier where applying error correction to quantum begins to improve things rather than adding complexity that eventually kind of leads to no tangible results? In the realm of error correction being actually effective?
So let me very briefly disambiguate. There are a couple of different words we use. One is error suppression or error mitigation. This is what we do at Q-Control. We also do quantum error correction. Quantum error correction is a very specific algorithm that underpins all these arguments about how we can build very, very large machines. It involves identifying and then fixing errors. It's an algorithm. Quantum error correction does not make things better. And I would say that, unfortunately, despite the tremendously beautiful progress going on, some of the media narrative has been quite misleading around where we are. Every time you do quantum error correction, you make things worse. We have not gotten to a point where you would actually choose to do that. But we are seeing beautiful, important scientific progress in demonstrating that all the primitives that make quantum error correction possible can work. Now, at IEEE Quantum Week, I gave a keynote presentation on making quantum error correction practical. And I really focused on how do we go from a theoretical or even an experimental scientific demonstration to a practically relevant technology that we deploy in quantum computers to make them better. And the summary message is there's a lot of work that needs to be done yet.
Wild. Unfortunately, I have to be the Grim Reaper and end this great conversation. So I don't normally do this, but I want to personally thank you for building a company that is dedicated to not only your central mission of infrastructure software, but also of building the quantum ready workforce, because I think that's that's what we're in it for. And I think that anybody that contributes to that is adding value. Plus all the other things that we talked about are so interesting. I hope you come back to join us sometime.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the very kind words and, of course, the invitation. It was a great conversation.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been great.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Entangled Things.
Bye-bye.